Blog Talk Radio.
For those folks who've lost their job right now because a plant went down to Mexico, you know, that isn't going to make you feel better. And so what we have to do is to make sure that folks are trained for the jobs that are coming in now, because some of those jobs of the past are just not going to come back. And when somebody says, like the person you just mentioned, who I'm not going to advertise for, that he's going to bring all these jobs back. Well, how exactly are you going to do that? What are you going to do? There's no answer to it. He just says, well, I'm going to negotiate a better deal. Well, how exactly are you going to negotiate that? What magic wand do you have? And usually the answer is he doesn't have an answer.
Yeah. Hey, everybody. James Bostic here. Conservative's Perspective on Patriot Nation Radio Network. You come over here to Blog Talk Radio, and then you look up the Patriot Nation Radio Network, and you'll find us here. This is one of two live incarnations we do with the program Tuesdays, Thursdays live, 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And then, of course, we have a recorded version that goes out over the Talk America Radio Network, and that's talkamericaradio.org. You can go there. Two audio streams, the Liberty and the Justice stream, ACP, heard various times throughout the day and the week there. Don't want to miss it. Well, as usual, here I am in front of this microphone, and not the first earthly idea what I'm going to talk about. But there are a lot of things to talk about, so I'm sure that one of these random neural firings that's going to come across here in just a little bit is going to hit upon something. Given our opening quote there from Homeboy, I guess we'll go with the big news economically from last week, and that is, of course, Donald Trump celebrated the second quarter 4.1% growth factor in the gross domestic product, South Lawn White House Friday, adding that the trade deals coming in will push future GDP numbers even higher. Trump said he was thrilled to announce the U.S. 4.1% growth rate for the second quarter. We are on track, he said, to hit the highest annual growth rate in over 13 years. As the trade deals come in one by one, we're going to go to a lot higher than these numbers, and these are great numbers. Trump forged a trade agreement at the White House last Wednesday with European Commissioner Jean-Claude Juncker that included not only promises to work toward a zero tariffs, zero non-tariff barriers, zero subsidies on all non-automotive industrial goods trade deal, but also that Juncker committed the European Union to begin immediately purchasing more U.S. soybeans, which has been an industry facing retaliatory tariffs from other nations such as China. So he's buffered this up. He's brokered a deal for the EU to take soybeans from American farmers as opposed to Chinese or Asian farmers. Go Big D. He pointed out that over the previous two administrations, the United States averaged a mere 1.8% GDP growth. Let me say that again. 1.8%. Our most recent GDP growth, 4.1. By contrast, we are now on track to hit an average gross domestic product annual growth rate of over 3%, and it could be substantially over 3%, Trump said. Each point, by the way, means approximately $3 trillion and 10 billion jobs. It doesn't sound like much, but it's a lot. If economic growth continues at this pace, he continued, the United States economy will double in size more than 10 years faster than it would have under either President Bush or President Obama. Perhaps one of the biggest wins in this report, he added, is that the trade deficit, very near to my heart, because we've been ripped off by the world, has dropped by more than $50 billion, $52 billion to be exact, said Trump. That's added, and adding 1 point to the GDP, that's a tremendous drop. By increasing growth to 3% over the next 10 years, that would mean 12 million new American jobs, $10 trillion of new American wealth at least. The president also said that's not including the fact that since I was elected, we've created approximately $7 trillion of new wealth. The year before I came into office, and don't you guys hate him because he's preaching well, the year before he came into office, private business investment grew at only 1.8%. Last year, it jumped to 6.3% his first year in office. This year, 9.4%. There hasn't been an increase like this in many, many years, many decades, maybe never. But seriously, it is it's from an economic standpoint, this is tremendous news. This is almost historic news. Trump then said that the most important thing, something confirmed to him by White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow and economic advisor Kevin Hassert, the numbers are sustainable. This isn't a one-time shot. I happen to think we're going to do extraordinarily well in our next report, next quarter, he said. When I came into office, 1.5 million fewer prime-aged Americans were working than 8 years before. We had lost almost 200,000 manufacturing jobs under the previous administration. Manufacturing jobs are not obsolete, but they're the greatest jobs we have. More than 10 million additional Americans have been added to food stamps in the past year, but we've turned it all around. Once again, we are the economic envy of the entire world, said President Trump, who cited the words of other world leaders. When I meet the leaders of other countries, the first thing they say invariably is, Mr. President, so nice to meet you. Congratulations on your economy. You're leading the entire world. America ladies and gentlemen, is being respected again, and America is winning again because we are finally putting America first, he added. I love reading Donald Trump's words. We've added 3.7 million new jobs since the election, a number that is unthinkable if you go back to the campaign. Nobody would have said it. Nobody would have even in an optimistic way projected it. This is the good stuff. Now, like I said, you're not going to hear it. And it is a big deal. Because under Obama, you know, we were told that a 1.8% growth, which was usually, if you remember, would be projected. And then within a month or two of making that projection, then the economists would dial it back to whatever the truth was. So, and they would do that quietly. That would be like on page four. Page one, you know, economic growth up 0.2%. Then, you know, sometime halfway through the second quarter, they go, well, we've changed that estimate. We've dropped it back down to, you know, 3% or what, 0.3%. So this is huge. How did he do it? Now, there are already those who are out there who have heard this that are in the Obama camp that are saying, well, it's because of all the things that Obama put in place that laid the groundwork for this sudden resurgence for the economy to skyrocket, coincidentally, as Barack Obama leaves office. Yeah, seriously, do you think we would be in this kind of shape economically if Hillary Clinton were running the show? No, we wouldn't. It would probably be even worse than it was during the Obama administration. So, yeah, it's god-awful. What did he do? Well, he freed up big business. He took the crippling, emasculating restrictions off businesses in this country. He unleashed industry and investment, and these guys took the ball, and they ran with it, and look what's happened. This is phenomenal. Unemployment, they say, and it is historic. I'm going to go ahead and call it historic. It's not the lowest it's ever been, but it's the lowest it's been since 1979. And 1979 was a very, very tough year for this country. A very tough year. Minority unemployment are at historic lows. It's one of the few times in this country we have more jobs than we have applicants for. It's getting to the point now that, you know, it's no longer, and it's getting even better for the employee, because now it's like no experience necessary. We'll teach you what to do. Get in here. We'll pay you. We'll teach you. Come on, we got to get going. That is economic dynamism. Well, what else we got to talk about? Takes care of that. I got to beat up on Barry since we went ahead and played that clip of that clown. And the ironic thing about that clip that we heard of Barack Obama talking about the magic wand and all that foolishness. The next day, after having said that, the news was released that Carrier had reached a deal with candidate Donald Trump after talking with him and changed their minds about relocating their plant to Mexico, and they stayed in the United States. But they don't want you to remember that. But that's how it went down, and that was probably pretty good. And in spite of all these things, and this is you know what? This is something else I was thinking about, because I was rolling around here thinking, what am I going to talk about? I have no idea, no clue. And I had what I like to call a recurrent epiphany. It strikes me, I recognize it, I go, I have my eureka moment, and then within a week or so, I kind of forget about it, and then, you know, it gets refreshed periodically. You know, basically, in the last 2 years, with the ascendancy of Donald Trump from being a candidate, declaring his candidacy, through the campaign, through the election, and now into the presidency, the second really, really positive shining year of his presidency. There's only been about five stories that are just kind of like recycled through the press and added on, like soap operas. Seriously, that's about it. We've got Russia. We got the collusion thing, right? We got the collusion thing. We've got the thing with the border. We've got Stormy Daniels. We've got Paul Manafort, which is, you know, that's kind of corollary to the, you know, to the Mueller investigation. We're going to talk a little bit about that too. We've got Hillary Clinton and the FBI cover-up involved with giving her a pass. And we can round it out with Peter Strzok and Lisa Page. That's it. Those are the stories that have fundamentally been rotating since Election Day 2016, when Donald Trump, you know, assumed the presidency. He won the presidency. And I thought about that for a minute. And really, if you stop and think about it, there they are. Now, there have been other stories, maybe bigger stories, maybe smaller stories, maybe much more significant stories than these, because none of these are really altogether that significant. When we look at the list of successes that we've seen economically and also in domestic as well as foreign policy fronts from the Trump administration. So, yeah, is the guy perfect? Is he a god? No. No, he's not. No. He does everything just like the rest of us, you know, one leg at a time. But he's uniquely suited for what's going on now. He's a man for the moment. And we should be thanking ourselves that we have a chief executive of the caliber of Donald Trump. However, I digress. We weren't talking about Donald. But back to Donald Trump. You've heard all these polls, and this is the setup for the thing, that Americans believe Donald Trump's the worst president in history, or presidential scholars have ranked Donald Trump dead last. Well, I can tell you right now, Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea, to ignore those polls, to ignore those so-called experts, while it may be too early to properly gauge presidential rankings for future presidents, I am pretty confident that history will ultimately judge Barack Obama as the worst president our nation has ever seen. And Jimmy Carter is probably jumping up and down and hugging people and giving people high fives and tooting the horn and waving, and he's building houses again. And this is the truth. The mountain of evidence that condemns his presidency to the bottom of the barrel is overwhelming. And there's a book called The Worst President in History, Barack Obama. It's written by a guy named Matt Margulis. He's just recently re-released it. And in this book, he has got 200 reasons why history will prove our belief correct in the years to come. And he gave us 6 abbreviated reasons here, which, believe me when he says this, because I've looked at some of the stuff in his book, these are just the tip of the iceberg. 6, the top 6 reasons Barack Obama, suckiest president in the galaxy. Number 6. And I don't know that they're in any specific order, but that's how he's got them. We're descending, all right? They're all bad, so it's not like one's worse than the other. Weaponizing the government against his enemy. The most well-known example of the Obama administration abusing its power to target Obama's political enemies is the infamous IRS scandal. Over a 2-year period leading up to the 2012 election, Tea Party groups and other conservatives were improperly scrutinized by the IRS. 12 different IRS offices across the country were involved, and the entire operation was orchestrated out of Washington, D.C. There was also evidence of White House involvement. The IRS also targeted private individuals critical of Obama, GOP candidates, and Mitt Romney donors. Also, there are examples of conservative individuals being targeted as the result of gross abuse of power by the Obama administration. Conservative author Dinesh D'Souza was indicted for campaign finance violations for a crime typically not prosecuted at all. James O'Keefe from Project Veritas was put on a terrorism watch list after a video was released of him dressed as a terrorist crossing back and forth over the U.S.-Mexico border to demonstrate the lack of border security. That is kind of a cool video. I understand why they got ticked off at him, because that was good. But Obama's pièce de résistance came when it came to the abuse of powers, probably spying on the Trump campaign, the Steele dossier on Trump. And this, again, a salacious, by the conspirator's own words, a salacious and unverifiable document. Also, partisan opposition research funded by the Democrat National Committee and the Hillary Clinton campaign, loaded with loads of bogus and salacious stuff, was used to secure a FISA warrant to spy on the Trump campaign. Anti-Trump partisans were involved in the investigation, and based on text messages between investigators Peter Strzok and Lisa Page, who were really good friends, we know that Strzok saw the investigation as an insurance policy in case Trump won the election, and that Page, worried that Trump would win, was told by Strzok, "No, baby, no, he won't. We'll stop it." Other text messages indicated that Obama wanted to be kept in the loop of the investigation. So the independence and integrity of the FBI took a major blow during the Obama years, and we are just now learning how bad that really was. Hello. Hey, you know, I'm not going to say anything. We're not going to talk about it. That's just the way the thing goes. It's a crying shame, and I'm not exactly sure why I'm not pulling up all the rest of this article, but we're not going to go view the original. You can bet your butt on that. Obamacare. We'll just go ahead, and I can go from the top of my head. I can give you way more than six reasons that are criminal about this guy. Obamacare, the only president in history who approved legislation that coerced the American public to purchase a product or be fined. You know, there'd be criminal consequences. We talked about weaponizing various arms of the government, including the FBI and the DOJ. Cash for clunkers. Anybody remember Cash for Clunkers? Fast and Furious. These guys gave guns away to the Mexican drug cartels. Enough guns to equip a Marine combat regiment. That's not an exaggeration. That's the truth. 50 caliber Browning sniper rifles. Big stuff. M4 carbines, pistols, machine guns, all of it. They gave it. They gave it away. Ostensibly to track how it was going to come back into the United States. But that's, there you go. And we still don't know the truth behind all that. Trying to release all the prisoners from Guantanamo, basically a catch-and-release program on terrorists. The recidivism rate of prisoners who were released from Guantanamo that went back into the battlefield to try and kill American soldiers again was over 80%. the stimulus package, going to create all these shovel-ready jobs that it never created. Rubber stamping Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, to turn over to Russia almost a quarter of our uranium reserves through Uranium One and Rosatom. That's probably five. We'll go with that. So this is not the kind of stuff that Donald Trump does. Donald Trump negotiates. Look at everything that's happened. And again, all we've got to do is look at the story. You know, they're the same five, six stories that run, and then you've got other ones that run in the foreground as they go by. You know, the Helsinki summit, the Singapore summit, the chewing up on the EU, slapping around on our buddies in NATO, all this stuff. But look at the results. Guys in NATO are starting to pony up what they're supposed to pay. They're mad about it, and they don't like it, but they're paying. We just got a more advantageous trade agreement set up with the European Union. Andrew Klavan did something really cool on this. And well, you know what? I think what we'll do, we'll save that for the other side of the break. We're down to the bottom of the hour, and I got to try and recalibrate some things. I want to share some more with you on what we were talking about. Having said that, let me say this. We're going to pull up some music. We'll be back after this brief musical interlude with more of a conservative's perspective right here, blogtalkradio.com, through the studios of the Patriot Nation Radio Network. Back after this.
Take my hand, don't feel the reaper.
I got a fever. The only prescription is more cowbell. James Bostic here, Conservative's Perspective. We're doing this live Tuesday nights as we do Tuesdays and Thursdays, 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And we do it here at Blog Talk Radio. And what you do is you go to Blog Talk Radio and you look for the Patriot Nation Radio Network. And that's where you're going to find ACP, plus our buddy Mark Hoffman. He has a show that he does on Mondays, and then he and I are back-to-back on Thursday, starting at 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Plus, we have the recorded version that we do for the There's so many. The Talk America Radio Network, talkamericaradio.org. You go there, two audio streams, the Liberty and the Justice stream, ACP heard on both of those various times throughout the day and the week, along with a veritable plethora of outstanding hosts and programming. And you don't want to miss a minute any of that as well. And ACP is humbled and proud to be moving in that rarefied air. Let's talk a little bit about all this crap that Donald Trump has done that Barack Obama couldn't do, wouldn't do. I'm inclined to think could not do. And would have been unwilling, given his ideology and his vision of the country, which is fundamentally, I haven't made up my mind if it is anti-American or un-American. And there's a little bit of difference between the two. I think it may just be in a question of virulence, but he was never really a very pro-American guy, Barack Obama. Donald Trump is an extremely pro-American guy, and that's one of the things that resonates the strongest with me when it comes to the big D. Plus, he is a negotiator. So how did he do all these things that he's done? Nobody since the Korean War has been able to secure the remains of our war dead. Donald Trump did so. Nobody has busted the cap on 400-plus Russian military advisors and killed them, okay? Killed 400 Russian cats in Syria. Have you heard Vladimir Putin talking anything about this? No, and you won't. Because he understands that now he is dealing with an American president who will not hesitate to use military force to see to the interests of United States concerns. Well, he's a negotiator. Oh, and by the way, think about this. He killed those Russians while he was having chocolate cake with Chinese President Xi Jinping. Had a terrific dinner down in Mar-a-Lago. I remember he said the cake was just, it may have been the best cake ever. It was rich. The icing was delicious. And it was a terrific cake. And they're eating cake. And then one of these little yellow minions from Xi Jinping comes over and tells him what's just happened. Yeah. Okay. Think about that. So he's a negotiator. He negotiates. And I have said this before. I think that there's probably no man who has sat in the Oval Office since the Second World War. We could probably go back, but that's a pretty long time right there. And we got to find a cutoff point for in terms of our relevancy. Since the Second World War, I don't think there has been any man better suited to sit in that office based on his negotiation experience. I think also that there's never been a president who has sat in this office since the Second World War who was more gifted and more able to take these psychological profiles, these psychological assessments that they have of all the people that America is going to be dealing with in foreign policy or militarily or whatever. I think that he can take that information and exploit it better than anyone who's ever sat in that office. And we're very fortunate to have this kind of guy in there, especially at this point in time from a historical perspective or a conservative perspective, either one. The point is, negotiation is what? It's give and take. It's back and forth. It's movement. The truth isn't available or it isn't in any given moment. It's in the whole process from beginning to end. If someone says, that's my last offer, that doesn't mean it's his last offer. If someone says it's over, it doesn't mean it's over. And if someone says he loves you, it doesn't mean that he loves you either. It's all part of the game. Everybody gets this. It's part of the negotiation. Donald Trump is a negotiator. He told us this from the very beginning. Not everything he says means what it means. Not every final decision he makes is final. And just because he says he loves you doesn't mean he does. He's in motion towards a goal. And the truth is in the motion. By now, most of us get this when it comes to Donald Trump, except the press. They just hate him too much to take him as he is, to take him as he has always said he is. They don't accept he's in a moving negotiation. If he says it's over and it's not over, they call him a liar. If he says he loves Putin, they declare he loves Putin. And by now, most of us understand Donald Trump doesn't operate that way. But not the press. To be fair, there are some commentators with honest concerns. They feel that as President, Trump's words should have more weight than the negotiator's words. He shouldn't say it's over unless it's really over. He shouldn't say he loves you if you happen to be a gangster piece of garbage like Vladimir Putin or Kim Jong-un. Fair enough. There's a price you pay for everything, and there's a price America will pay for having a president who approaches truth as a negotiator. But as we all saw this week, there are lots of benefits as well. When the week started, the press and politicians on both sides, the left and the right, were in full hen-clucking hysteria over Trump's trade policies. Tariffs are the greatest, Trump tweeted. And in the press and Congress, players on both sides were declaring free trade dead and the end of the economy was nigh. They neglected to recall that Trump had also said at the G summit back in June that all tariffs and trade barriers should be lifted. No tariffs, no barriers. That's the way it should be. Tariffs and the threat of tariffs were clearly Trump's way of bringing our trading partners to the table. And he said this too. They're all coming, he declared in a speech just this week. They don't want to have those tariffs put on them. They're all coming to see us. Trump negotiates. The press lies. And, you know, we look time and time again, just like I said at the top of the hour, okay, with a 4.1 on the GDP. That's monstrous. There are very few times in this country's history where we have had more jobs than we have people needing jobs. Minority unemployment at historic lows. Unemployment in general, lowest than it's been since 19, that's 40 years. That's huge. But you're not going to hear a whole lot of it on the mainstream. You're not going to hear a whole lot of it out there anywhere. You're not going to hear about any of the positive things, any of the constructive takeaways that we're seeing, any of the benefits, and it's a little soon to see them, but they're taking place. And he did it through negotiation. We're going to move on to this last thing that I want to talk about, and it's not cool at all. Sunday night a week ago, a Muslim named Faisal Hussein strolled down Danforth Avenue in Toronto's Greek town. It's a popular area known for its bistros and cafes. And Hussein pulled out a gun, and he started firing into some of those restaurants. He murdered two people, and he injured another 13. And when this happens, and this happens way too frequently, The most obvious explanation is that Hussein was answering the call of the Islamic State and al-Qaeda for individual Muslims to murder civilians in Western countries. They set out this call excuse me, in September 2014. So, oh, Muwahid, do not let this battle pass you by wherever you may be. You must strike at the soldiers, the patrons, and the troops of the Tawagit. Strike their police, security, and intelligence members, as well as their treacherous agents. Destroy their beds. Embitter their lives for them and busy them with themselves. If you can kill a disbelieving American or European, especially the spiteful and filthy French or an Australian or a Canadian or any other disbeliever from the disbelievers waging war, including the citizens of the countries that entered into a coalition against the Islamic State, then what you do is you rely upon Allah and you kill him in any manner or way, however it may be. If you're not able to find an IED or a bullet, then single out the disbelieving American, Frenchman, or any of their allies. Smash his head with a rock. Slaughter him with a knife. Run him over with your car. Throw him down from a high place or choke him or poison him. Squeaky chair. Sorry about that. Hussein's family, on the other hand, ready with a different explanation. His parents issued a statement saying, "Our son had severe mental health challenges, struggling with psychosis and depression his entire life. And while we did our best to seek help for him throughout his life of struggle and pain, we could never imagine that this would be his devastating and destructive end." Yeah. Not dead air, I'm here. This might be more convincing had we not heard it so many, many times before. Last week in Paris, a Muslim hit a 69-year-old Jewish man, knocking him to the ground and then dragged him by the hair, all the while screaming, "Allahu Akbar, long live Hitler, death to the Jews." The attacker was sent for psychiatric evaluation. French authorities are apparently not even considering the possibility that he is a jihad terrorist with Islam's special hatred for Jews. Likewise, June 2017, a Muslim stalked through a Jewish area of London screaming, "Allah, Allah, I'm going to kill you all." He wasn't a jihadi. A police spokesman explained, "He was detained by officers under the Mental Health Act. No one was injured. This is not being treated as terror-related." Also, June 2017, a Muslim in a metro station in Lausanne, Switzerland, began screaming Allahu Akbar, causing commuters to run away in terror. But there's nothing to be concerned about because the prosecutor explained, "This is a person who was afraid his life was in danger. And at the height of his crisis, he began to face paranoia. Then he called to God for help." That's what he did last Friday in the subway, shouting Allahu Akbar. No, I'm not making it up. I can't make it up. March 2017, a Muslim in Germany attacked a 59-year-old man riding his bicycle, bashing his skull with a hammer. Oh, that means a Muslim. Police announced the suspect may have had a mental illness and stressed this was not a jihad attack, as the attacker was simply mentally ill. Another Muslim in Germany who wounded 9 people with an axe in a train station was also not a jihadi. He had some mental health issues there. May 2016, a Muslim screaming, "Allahu Akbar, an infidel, you must die," stabbed 4 people, killing one at a train station near Munich. Nonetheless, Bavarian security officials immediately denied that he had an Islamic extremist motive. What caused the attack? Bavaria's state interior minister said that the attacker had mental disorders. A Muslim was arrested in June 2016 for a jihadist plot to attack tourists and police. He was found with a knife and a machete, and according to the London Daily Telegraph, the suspect had a history of psychiatric problems and has been diagnosed as schizophrenic, but is considered nonetheless truly radicalized with a serious profile. Now, here's the deal. They were forced to do that because if they hadn't found any documentation of this plan to attack tourists and police, they would never have mentioned radicalization in any form or fashion. They would have just put it down to him being another Muslim wingnut. August 2016, a Muslim stabbed six people in London, murdering one of them. The BBC reported that the Assistant Commissioner for Specialist Operations said the investigation was increasingly pointing to the attack being triggered by mental health issues. Oh, God, this is a mouthful. There was also the verdict in the case of Gyulcira Bobakulova, the Muslim woman who in May 2016 beheaded a four-year-old girl, then paraded her severed head through the streets of Moscow. She screamed Allahu Akbar while brandishing the child's head and said that Allah had ordered her to behead the girl. She seems to have had an Islamic State boyfriend. She had become religious not long before the beheading, started wearing hijab, said the beheading was revenge for Russian airstrikes on Muslims in Syria. She told her son to pray five times a day and to live in accord with Sharia law. Despite all that, she was declared insane and not brought to trial. In Uruguay, a Muslim, screaming Allahu Akbar, stabbed a Jewish man to death and later explained that in committing this murder, he had followed Allah's order, but a judge ruled he was suffering from chronic psychosis of a schizophrenic type and was not able to appreciate the wrongfulness of his actions. In the same way, a Muslim who was shouting Allahu Akbar outside a Brooklyn synagogue in May 2016 and had two knives in his car was, according to the New York Daily News, nothing to be concerned about. Investigations by the NYPD and FBI showed he was emotionally disturbed and not a terrorist threat. Nothing to see here. Move along. Show's over. Show's over. Move along. Mental illness apparently also the cause of anti-Americanism among Muslims. The Military Times reported that in November 2015, a Jordanian police captain opened fire in an international police training facility, killing two Americans and three others. The government subsequently portrayed the police captain as troubled. Well, of course, what else could he be? But here's the rub, ladies and gentlemen, and this is something we need to stop and consider. What those who dismiss jihadist terrorist activity as a mental illness never think about and never consider is it could be both. Let's say Faisal Hussein really, truly struggled with mental issues throughout his life, as his family claims. He may have considered himself to be under a curse from Allah and decided to do something great to get into that deity's good graces. And Islam teaches there is no deed greater than jihad. Now, Faisal Hussein was tormented by the idea that he had sinned. He also might have been trying to make sure that the scale holding his good deeds outweighed the scale holding his evil deeds by performing what is, in Muhammad's view, the greatest deed of all. So there is, in sum, no reason why an act of jihad terror can't be performed by someone who's on the psychically marginal edge, and plenty of reasons why someone who is psychically marginal might opt for jihad. But we're certain to hear even more of the same old excuses in the coming days, along with the admonitions that only by rejecting Islamophobia are we going to be able to stop future Faisal Husseins. The mental health of would-be Islamic jihadis will be, like everything else, made the responsibility of non-Muslims, just as it is the responsibility of non-Muslims to bend over backwards to accommodate Muslim demand so as to prevent radicalization. The jihad imperative, though, in the Sunnah and in the Quran is open-ended. Look, jihad is going to be way just... And this is what, well, if we're nice, they'll be cool to us because we're nice. Jihad is to be waged against all infidels, not just those who are Islamophobic or not just those who don't want to appease. And so all the claims after this latest jihadist attack that Muslims are the real victims of jihad and require special accommodation, probably will wind up with it in Justin Trudeau's Canada. In Justin Trudeau's Canada. And maybe, I am skeptical, however, it's going to do anything to prevent more Faisal Husseins from going around the bend. And I guarantee you, it will do absolutely nothing to blunt the force of advancing jihad. The thing is, folks, and these are the facts, you're not going to like it, but this is the truth. You can't reason with these people by and large. And the reason you can't reason with these people is because they are mental defectives. I know. And I'm not saying this. Here's the deal. There's a guy named Nikolai Sennels. He's a Danish psychologist. And if those of you have been aware of what's going on in the Nordic countries, in Denmark, in Norway, in Finland, in Sweden, the invasion of Muslims is unreal. It's horrifying. They're reverting to Sharia law. Classic cities in these countries are no-go zones at night. And here's the deal. It's because Muslims have been enjoying 1,400 years of inbreeding, marrying first cousins, consanguineous marriages. Okay, and what this does, 1,400 years of it, it's wreaking havoc on Muslim intelligence, from a collective standpoint, Muslim intelligence and health and sanity. A large part of inbred Muslims naturally are born from parents who are themselves inbred. I've only got 5 minutes. I'm going to try and wrap this up. I'm going to throw some stats at you that's going to really mess you up. Combining Nikolai and Dr. Sennels' research and other studies, Sennels says that the genetic damage of intermarriage, which is part of Islamic religion and culture, since their prophet said it was cool, it is lowering intelligence quotients, it's increasing physical defects, and it is enhancing greater incidences of mental illness. Almost half of the Muslims worldwide are estimated to be inbred. 70% of marriages in Pakistan, inbred. 67% of marriages in Saudi Arabia. 80% in Nubia and southern Egypt are consanguineous marriages. The children of these consanguineous marriages have a lower intelligence quotient than children of non-related parents. Research shows that the IQ is on average 10 to 16 points lower in children born of related parents, and that abilities related to social behavior develop slower in inbred babies. And children born of cousins are twice as likely as the general population to have mental or physical disabilities, which what drains municipal funds, entitlements, and health benefits. Somebody's got to take care of these things. These are serious mental health issues. And when we and they've got and how do we take care of them? Well, we take care of them through government entities. Two-thirds of all immigrant school children with Arab backgrounds are illiterate. Still, after 10 years in the Danish school system, and the Danish education system is nothing to sneeze at. Special education costs for slow learners consume a third of the budget in Danish schools, and Muslim immigrants and their children have a very high rate of unemployment because of limited skills, because they're low functioning. Sennels, however, draws broader conclusions. The limited ability to understand, appreciate, and produce knowledge following a limited IQ is probably one of the reasons why Muslim countries produce only one-tenth of the world average when it comes to scientific research. Lack of interest in science and human development in the Muslim world is clear in the United Nations Arab Human Development Reports. They conclude there have been fewer books translated into Arabic in the last 1,000 years than the amount of books translated within the country of Spain every single. All right, you see what's going on here? This is serious stuff. So there's nothing that can, you know, take away from the argument. It may possibly be both. We're down to the bottom of it. Running late again. Thanks, folks, once again for tuning in. ACP Heard Here live Tuesdays and Thursdays, 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Also, TalkAmericaRadio.org. You go to TalkAmericaRadio.org, and there are two streaming channels there, Liberty and Justice Streams. ACP Heard on both of those, as well as an outstanding lineup of top-shelf programming and hosts. Thank you guys so much for the opportunity to be here. We'll be back on Thursday taking a look at things as we do through a conservative's perspective. God bless all of you. God bless America. We'll see you then.